Hey everyone, this is Harmon, and you've tuned in to another episode of Comedy History 101. Today we have a very special CH101 select on the history of the Comedy Store condo. You know the comedy club, the Comedy Store? Well, there was a condo behind it, and in that condo, comedians live. Comedians such as Sam Kennison, Andrew Dice Clay, and of course, our favorite, Yakov Smirnoff. And normally we read viewer comments at the end of the episode, but since this is a CH1 select, I like to read a comment by a listener named Sharon, who commented on the history of Yakov Smirnoff and said, "He's not from Russia. He's from the Ukraine. He left there at 26 when it was still part of the USSR. Well, thank you, Sharon. Thanks for sharing that. Sharon also went on to say, "I interviewed him, Yakov Smirnoff, this weekend. He's currently in Turkey with his new wife, Olivia, celebrating Ukrainian Independence Day with her and her family. They couldn't do it in the Ukraine because of virus restrictions. He's working with theaters across the nation to promote a live stream event Saturday, pre-recorded at his theater in Branson, Missouri." Thanks again, Sharon. And also, if you want to have your comment read here on Comedy History 101, take some time to like, subscribe, and of course, comment wherever you get the podcast, be it iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or on our website, comedyhistory101.com. And without further ado,
you're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Good thing about doing comedy in Russia, you have captured audience.
You're stupid. Everybody's so stupid.
Comedy History 101.
Yeah, I'm in New York. I got to fly back to LA. I can just now talk about this. I'm flying. This was 2 years ago. Oh, I remember the fucking day! I'm flying back from New York. It's 2 years ago. I did drugs then. Oh, they see through me! They see through me!
What we just heard there was the legendary comedian Sam Kennison talking about doing drugs, which leads us directly into our episode today of
Comedy History 101.
Where we talk about the history of comedy. Because today's episode, I am Harmon Leon, by the way, and with me, of course, is Scott Kalanico. How are you, Scott?
Howdy. I'm doing good, Harmon. How are things over there?
Yeehaw! I'm doing excellent. But it leads us into our episode today, not only of drugs, not only of Sam Kennison, but we're going to do a history of the legendary Comedy Store condo. They called it Crest Hill. What do you know about Crest Hill, Scott?
I think there might have been some drugs done there.
Anything else?
That was mostly what I was just kind of referencing. I thought we kind of covered that, but apparently there was a lot of drugs going on there. So yeah, and a lot of famous comedians all kind of lived together. It was kind of the frat house for 80s comedians.
Yeah, exactly. It was the frat house of 80s comedians, and it was also kind of a sign of the changing of the times of stand-up comedy, because Mitzi Shore basically gave the Comedy Store condo to the comedians in, I believe it was 1979. And as the listeners of this podcast, Comedy History 101, know from our episode on the Comedy Store strike, originally, like, stand-up comedy was sort of carefree back in the, like, early 70s, and all that kind of changed when Freddie Prinze got a sitcom by doing a set at the Comedy Store, and the comedians went on strike at the Comedy Store because they demanded to be paid. And Scott, was it an ugly thing, Comedy Store strike?
Yes, it was a little ugly. I just want to clarify that they weren't going on strike because Freddie Prinze got a deal. That's not why they were on strike. They were just on strike because they felt like they deserved a little bit of payment for all the work that they were doing. And I happen to agree with them.
Yeah, and the Comedy Store, as we all know, was owned and run by Mitzi Shore, who sadly this month passed away. But she was the backbone and kind of energy of the Comedy Store. And again, we covered this in our episode on the history of the Comedy Store strike. Sammy Shore, who is Pauly Shore's father, along with Mitzi Shore, opened the Comedy Store, I believe, was it 1973?
1973 is what it says in the note. 1974. 1975, it looks like about. They divorced in 74.
Yeah, but Sammy opened it, and then divorced right, yeah, in 1974. Right. So I believe it was like, yeah. So again, if you want to know the exact year the Comedy Store opened, listen to our episode on the history of the Comedy Store strike, because we clearly give that date. But this is not a history when the Comedy Store opened. This is not that episode.
No, that's a different episode.
Yeah, but basically this leads to the Comedy Store condo, which they divorced. Sammy Shore and Mitzi Shore divorced in 1974. And in order to lower his alimony payments, Sammy Shore, did you know, like, he opened for like Elvis Presley?
Yeah, that was like his big claim to fame, is that he was open for Elvis Presley, and Pauly Shore was bounced on Elvis's lap, apparently.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that one.
Yeah, that was...
So anyways, he and Mitzi divorced in 1974, and in order to get lower alimony payments, he just simply gave her the Comedy Store Comedy Club.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the deal, and it was a pretty big house. It's a 1925 Spanish-style four-bedroom, four-bathroom home, which is, that's not huge, but it's pretty big by today's standards. It was about 5,000 square feet. Over right off the Sunset Strip.
Yeah, so basically, Mitzi Shore got the club in 1974, but in 1976, she negotiated to buy the entire building. And part of the deal of buying the entire building is they got the Crest Hill home, which was located directly behind the club as part of the deal. And again, this is not a history of the Comedy Store, but the Comedy Store used to be called Ciro's Nightclub, which was like one of the biggest nightclubs in Hollywood between, I'd say, like 1940s to like early 60s or so. And it was a nightclub where like Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis used to perform at. And they also used to go party at the Crest Hill House after the show.
Yeah, and there was some kind of a rumor, I don't know if it was ever proven, but some people think there was or there used to be a underground tunnel that linked the house to the Comedy Store, or the nightclub at the time.
Yeah, and a lot of what we're referencing is in this BuzzFeed article on the history of the Comedy Store condo. I believe they thought there was a tunnel, but the guy who wrote the story went with a real estate agent, and they opened up this cubbyhole. And it was just sort of just a kind of a cubby hole without a tunnel, just but full of cobwebs.
It could have been there, though. That's what I'm just saying. I'm saying it could be there.
But what connects it is this house, this Crestville house, this Spanish-style home, four bedrooms, four bathrooms, located at 8420 Crest Hill Road, was always a party house. It was a party house with the Rat Pack. They were partying there when Frank Sinatra was smacking around the broads.
Yeah, hey, give me another drink, girly.
Give me another drink, girly. I'm going to smack around the broads.
Forget about it. No, that's, I don't know why he did.
But he's from Hoboken, New Jersey.
Right, exactly.
So in 1979, as you all know from our previous episode, comedian Steve Lebetkin jumped off the roof of the Riot Hyatt and into the Comedy Store parking lot, which ended the Comedy Store strike. It didn't end, but that was like one of the bitter ends of this kind of innocent era of comedy. Mm-hmm. And after settling the strike, Mitzi Shore's kind of as a reconciliation of this bitter strike, started putting up comedians at the Crest Hill home as a perk of being part of the Comedy Store family.
Right. She wasn't... it wasn't like putting people up, but it was like, hey, here's a free room. It was more like kind of a, hey, you need a place to crash tonight after your set. Here you go.
Yeah, but comedians like actually started living there. Right, I mean, because it was like the first comedian to live there. And again, he's completely lost in history, but at one time was like on the fast track of being one of the biggest comics in the country was Argus Hamilton.
Are you an alcoholic? Take this simple test. Do you often ask for that fourth or fifth drink? Before breakfast. Do you find it impossible to drive without a beer between your legs?
Yeah, he's still around. I put a note if people want to go look at his website, argushamilton.com. And the really weird thing is you look at the website, looks like it hasn't been updated since 1997, and when in fact it was updated just this month. So it has frames and everything. So Argus is still out there doing comedy.
Yeah, and he was the first one to move into the house. I think he was also, he was also dating Mitzi Shore. So
right,
that was
yeah.
part of the deal. Mm-hmm. But some of the original people that moved into the house was Andrew Dice Clay.
Jack and Jill went up the hill both with a buck and a quarter. Jill came down with 250.
Andrew Silverstein, who you might know about from where? Our last episode of Comedy History 101.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
We talked about the controversy.
Controversy.
Back then, did you see the E! True Hollywood documentary on the Comedy Store?
Yes, I did.
It is so funny because they have early Andrew Dice Clay.
I realize that was no introduction for me. We'll just leave it at nature's masterpiece for now. My name's Dice.
Where he's like wearing a suit jacket, but he was kind of like a crime noir kind of character.
Yeah,
it was a totally different character. It was like they had like a stand-up bass sort of playing behind him. And he was kind of like a Humphrey Bogart Maltese Falcon type. Kind of thing, like, my name's Dice. You know, it's like, it was a completely different character. I mean, again, it was interesting to see that he eventually evolved that from, you know, everything has to have a start. But,
yeah. Yeah, well, he's in the movie, what's the movie? I think he's in, I think it's Pretty in Pink. He's in one of the John Hughes movies as a doorman.
Yeah, he's in Pretty in Pink.
Yeah, that's the one.
But this was like, I mean, it was like black and white video that, you know, it was probably from the 70s because... Uh-huh. I believe people started moving into the Comedy Store house. It was 1979 when Argus Hamilton began to move in. And he lived there with a comedian from Detroit named Mike Biner, who everyone called Kid Comedy. Do you find anything on Mike Biner?
Oh, yeah. He's actually still – he's kind of out there. He does a lot of movies.
Who's Mike Biner?
I'm Mike Biner. Welcome to the Westwood Comedy Store. For those of you that don't know, we have a comedy store on Sunset Boulevard. We have a comedy store in La Jolla. And for those of you that don't get a lot of the jokes tonight, we're opening up a brand new remedial comedy store.
Wow. He's done a lot of movies. The first movie was a movie called Coupe de Ville. It was back in the 1990. And then did a bunch of movies, uh-huh. And then did like a Will Smith movie where he wrote and directed it. But then he was... The mind behind The Mind of the Married Man, which was on HBO, like an HBO kind of sitcom back when they were first starting that, apparently received negative to mixed reviews.
So he's a behind the comic that turned behind the scenes
yeah.
kind of guy.
Yeah, he's a good comic, and he's still kind of active. He's doing movies and whatnot.
Yeah, so again, he and Argus Hamilton were like the first two comedians to move in there. And again, the reflection of, you know, suddenly, you know, you're a paid comedian. You can actually make money doing comedy. That kind of reflected with the rise of the Comedy Store condo. Because suddenly all these comedians that, you know, a couple of years before were striking because they wouldn't even be paid $15 a set. Suddenly, like, there's all these comedy clubs opening up all over the country. And because you had the clout of being, like, a Comedy Store guy, you're getting paid, like, you know, $5,000 a week to go headline in, you know, like, Houston or Atlanta.
Yeah, well, I mean, that back then, too, is, like, not only would they pay you, they'd pay your airfare, and then they'd put you up in their own, you know, each one of these clubs usually typically had a comedy condo that they'd put you up in.
Yeah, exactly. And this is like the first of that type of thing because, you know, first it's like suddenly, all right, these guys' jobs. They need a place to stay. And at their home club, they stay at these condos. Then they go on the road and stay. And yet, you know, the Atlanta version of the Comedy Store condo.
Well, I mean, that's kind of my, not to be controversial here, I guess I will be a little controversial, Harmon.
Why, are you going to be racist?
No, not that, no.
I'm just kidding.
Who was that?
Again? No, sorry.
No, who was that guy? Oh, we'll come back to him. Be sure to drop in.
We'll come to him, yeah. He's my new favorite comic, but yeah.
But
no,
go ahead. It's weird, because you think that, okay, the comedy condos, you typically think this is where the headliner stays, but I don't think at the time they didn't really have headliners at the Comedy Store, so they wouldn't have, maybe, they had a couple guys sleeping there, but it wasn't like they had a room reserved for headliners at the club below. They're all
headliners. Well, yeah. They would go on the road and headline, mm-hmm. but the Comedy Store is a showcase room,
right,
where it's like they don't have the headliner middle opener, right, sort of format. They just have, it's just showcase, main room and the original room. So it's really kind of, it's like a who's who of comedy that stayed at the condo, and essentially they're all, headliners, but this is where, they lived when they were off the road.
Right. Yes.
And along this time, this is like when Robin Williams starred in Working Mindy, and like Letterman was starting to guest host The Tonight Show a lot, and they were starting to get like famous people coming down to the Comedy Store, people like Willie Nelson, Burt Reynolds, Ringo Starr, Sugar Ray Leonard, and they all not only went to the Comedy Store, but afterwards they would party at the Crest Hill House.
I mean, not only just in addition to all those stars that you mentioned, Harmon, and they are stars indeed, mm-hmm. but another member.
Ringo played in a little group called The Beatles,
did. But
Burt Reynolds played in a little movie called Smokey and the Bandit.
That's right, and Smokey and the Bandit Part 2.
Not three. That starred Jackie Gleason.
Oh, that's right.
I think that was called Smokey is the Bandit.
Oh, that's right. Was he in Part 3? Oh, we'll have to look into that.
No, I think that one just starred Jackie Gleason. Okay. But anyways, that's a whole other podcast.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that'll be our next one. But also, in addition to all those stars, living in the comedy condo was Full House star Dave Coulier.
I think they should have Scooby and Shaggy work in the airport sniffing for drugs, because if anybody's going to find some weed, it's that Shaggy dude. What's that, Scoob? Rararana. Grab some for us, good buddy. See you in the van. Yeah, Scooby snacks.
Well, he was soon to be Full House star Dave Coulier.
Right, yeah,
he was just stand-up comedian Dave Coulier.
Right.
Yeah, and there was a story about him in 1979. They had another housemate who also worked as a runner for Mitzi, and he said that the guy, he went on the road one week, Dave Coulier, and he came back and this guy like stole all his clothes, and he denied it. And one night he was at the Westwood Comedy Store and he saw the guy like wearing one of his shirts.
Yeah, that gentleman, he's always referred to as, quote, mysterious housemate, unquote, Jack Leon Packer. And I tried to Google him a little bit, and I couldn't find anything. Couldn't find anything about the mysterious house.
Yeah, the BuzzFeed article would come up.
Yeah, no, that was it.
But that would be like the part of the movie where if you're in the William Campbell format, that would just be, that's an innocent. He just stole his shirt. That's innocent. And then it starts getting a little bit darker.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So next arrive was I bet you love this guy. He was from Russia. Do you know who I'm talking about?
No. Who? What was? Did he have a catchphrase or anything?
What surprises me, American people don't know we have comedy in Russia. We have comedians. They're there. They're dead. They're there. It's very hard to do comedy in Soviet Union. You have to write out all your material and you send it to Department of Jokes. I'm not making this up. They send it back to you censored. You have to stay with the script. You cannot improvise. If someone heckles you from the audience, you can't say, like, your mother wears army boots. Because she probably does. And she will hurt you.
Well, he was Russian, and he had trouble figuring out the ways things worked in America. And because he's Russian and not used to the American customs, he would always exclaim, "What a country!"
Oh my God, was this the Yakov Smirnoff?
Yes, the Yakov Smirnoff
from Ukraine.
And it's funny, they wrote there's something to think about. It's like, in part of his appeal was what they said is like he arrived in the 80s in the height of, you know, Reagan era Cold War paranoia. So he was like kind of like patriotic in a way of going, you know, Russia's horrible. America, what a country.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I'm a new immigrant.
Uh-huh.
And just another little trivia fact, he was very good as a handyman and actually worked for Mitzi at the Comedy Store as a handyman, like doing any kind of like electrical work. I think his father was an engineer.
Yeah, because he'd actually done, he worked on cruise or like the Russian version of cruise ships in the Black Sea. That was kind of what his career was before he came over to the States.
Yeah, I mean, he was a comedian, so yeah, yeah. He wasn't just like out of nowhere, but he was, you know, he was a Russian comedian.
Yeah.
So, you know, he had some chops. But how he got his break was he was on with Andrew Dice Clay on the Rodney Dangerfield Young Comedian special. And Yakov said he was kind of scared of Andrew Dice Clay. And then one day he heard a knock on the door at the Crest Hill house, and it was Andrew Dice Clay. Hey,
yeah.
I'm your new roommate.
Yeah, I think in between that, he was like, yeah, like you were saying, he was scared of Andrew Dice Clay. And then he was like, oh, wow, great. I'll never have to see that guy again. And then he moves to L.A. and it's like, whoop, that's your roommate.
Yeah, and the crazy part is, again, the Crest Hill house was a big party house, but yet Yakov Smirnoff and Andrew Dice Clay didn't really party. I know Yakov Smirnoff did, but I think Andrew Dice Clay was pretty kind of straight edge on the whole deal.
And I don't think they were technically roommates. I think they were housemates. It sounded like apparently Andrew Dice Clay had what was called the maid's room, or what used to be a maid's room, that was located off the kitchen, that had barred windows on it, from which he received a blowjob one time. But apparently, so he was right next to the kitchen.
Not from Yakov Smirnoff.
No, not from Yakov Smirnoff. Well, they weren't roommates, so that's what I was saying.
What a country!
Blowjob through the window. But apparently, the kitchen held a huge oak table, and that's kind of where people would hold court, and they would just kind of do their partying. So, yeah, that would be a little annoying if you were trying to be straight-edge dude and you were in the room right next to the party room.
Yeah, and that actually caused some of the tension. And Yakov, in his what a country sort of naivety, he would say every morning there would be a mirror on the table. He didn't know why, and he thought, why would someone take the mirror off the wall and eat powdered donuts over the mirror? What a crazy American tradition. And it wasn't powdered donuts. It was cocaine. Because some of the people, it was like Richard Pryor and Robin Williams would always be there. They said Richard Pryor would be there. You know, he was pretty darn established, you know, at that time.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, lots of blow would be around. Yeah. And so, you know, he would turn up.
In America, a mirror does you. In America, a mirror does you off mirror.
No, in America, you watch mirror. In Russia, mirror watches you.
Yeah, there you
do
go.
Cocaine.
Do cocaine. So do you think? So you're thinking? You think Yakov partied a little bit?
I don't think he did. He said he didn't.
Okay.
You know, he was just Russian and a handyman. I think it was somebody like Mike Binder or somebody said, you know, he was helped him. Like, I think he put an 8-foot-tall portrait of himself in the stairwell of the house.
Yes, of
something weird like that.
Yeah, of Yakov.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like some comedian that lived there said he helped Yakov put a 8-foot-tall portrait of Yakov over the stairway.
Yeah,
which is kind of funny.
Yeah, that is kind of funny.
I think I want that portrait.
That'd be pretty cool. I wonder where that is now. Maybe it's in the Yakov Smirnoff house of Branson.
Yeah, Branson, Missouri. Because it's basically, he has a theater called the Yakov Smirnoff Theater. So I think if they have an 8-foot-tall portrait, that would be the place where it would go. But Mike Biner recalls that when Robin Williams was there partying, there'd be lots of girls and lots of celebrities like Robin Williams, Andy Kaufman, Rod Stewart, who would all come to the house to score coke.
All right. And not powdered donuts.
Not powdered donuts whatsoever. Okay.
So, Harmon, when you bring up Coke, that means we're now approaching the 80s. So we're going to look at now for the period of 1981 to around 1984 in the old Comedy House. And that's when we had kind of a new influx of talent. And that came about when Argus Hamilton was gigging in Houston when he met Bill Hicks and Sam Kinison, who were back in Houston known as the Outlaw Comics. They were a big deal in Houston at the Comedy Workshop there. I think there was a Comedy Workshop in Austin as well, like an annex. But yeah, the Outlaw Comics, yeah, they were a big deal. They were known around the town. And also another one of the Outlaw Comics who will come up later on is a gentleman by the name of Carl LeBeouf.
That's the sound that a man makes in his mind when he sees a woman he really wants.
He was also at the time, and I guess Hamilton kind of convinced those guys to move out to L.A., and they had a place, so I know Bill Hicks and Sam Kinison were going out there. So they all eventually moved out there, and Kinison, believe it or not, became the doorman at the Comedy Store in the early 80s. He slept at the Westwood location, but then partied at the house, the Crest Hill house on Sunset. How far? The Westwood's not too far, right?
Yeah, that's where UCLA is. Yeah, so yeah. It's not a far. I mean, it's like if you go straight down Sunset, it leads you right to UCLA. Okay. But then again, you know, everything in LA is just a little bit farther away than you think, but it's not far whatsoever. And how Argus Hamilton met Sam Kinison was he was in Houston gigging, and he's on the table was the biggest, like, I don't, what do you call, like, a ball of cocaine? A rock? I don't even know these drug turds. Yeah. And he said on the other side of the eight ball was Sam Kinison, and that was the first time that he met him.
There you go. Welcome. Welcome to Houston.
Yeah, and so Sam Kinison moved out. And again, you know, we'll do a whole nother episode just on Sam Kinison, but he was just one of those guys. He had just had that, you know, he was a preacher, so he had that preacher stage presence. So he knew how to work a crowd. And he's just been really exciting to watch because just everyone would go, he would just be the ultimate comedian's comedian, you know, when he was on stage. So anyways, so the Crest Hill House, so Sam Kinison eventually moved into the Crest Hill House, and sort of like the place became like a comedy laboratory where, you know, through like all night bullshit sessions or just staying up doing drugs, you know, the comedians sort of tested and honed material out on each other. And Andrew Dice Clay put it in his book that he took sort of claim that he helped Sam Kinison come up with his screaming sort of bit.
Okay, well, continue.
Continue.
Oh, was that it? Okay. I don't know how much I, you know, from what I know, he was kind of a screamer when he was at the Comedy Store. I mean, in Houston at the Comedy Workshop. And the kind of story there is that after he got banned from the Comedy Workshop, Kinison went across the street to some gas station and set up a cross and kind of crucified himself and just kind of yelled at people at the Comedy Workshop for, you know, Friday and Saturday nights. So I think he was kind of a yeller beforehand.
Yeah, actually, there's a good documentary on Sam Kinison that explains that whole story, which is really funny.
Yeah.
And according to Andrew Dice Clay, that he helped him with his trademark scream by helping him on his timing of how to slowly build into that and then eventually let out that primordial scream. But according to Sam Kinison's brother, Bill, who is also Sam Kinison's manager, his take on Dice claiming this is, his in his words, bullshit.
I think then you get another angle on the story, which is pretty interesting because, of course, these two were doing practicing their screams in the kitchen, and then also who slept kind of near to the kitchen was Yakov Smirnoff. So while they're practicing their screams, this wakes up Smirnoff, and he wakes up and he comes into the kitchen, and basically his story is that Dice and Clay and Dice and Kinison and some other people were involved in this fake fight. and they all thought it was so funny that they should try it on stage. So they all just kind of trekked down to the Comedy Store, which is right down there down the hill. It was 1 o'clock in the morning, and there's nobody there, but they went ahead and did it anyway, and they just said it was just hilarious. That was where Kinison's scream was born, according to Smirnoff.
Yeah, and that seems like what the fun of that house was in the more sort of innocent sort of times, is that you lived right behind the Comedy Store, and the Comedy Store ran, you know, shows to like 2 a.m, and, you know, you could go there and conceivably just, you know, work on a bit and then just jump up on stage and do it. And, you know, and you had a house full of people that were soon to be comedy legends.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the other kind of, not comedy, but just kind of a legend in his own right. This is like one of the surprising things I learned was that, after mm-hmm. Argus Hamilton, who was the original kind of, if we'll go back to one of the original guys who first stayed there, after he moved out, another young comedian took over his room, and that was Tom Wilson, who many of you probably know better as Biff from the Back to the Future films.
Wow. Good evening. I'm really excited to be here. You excited to be here in this section over here? Huh? Come on! I'm not fooling around up here. I got a tuba and I'll use it, folks, okay?
So he started out as a stand-up, which I never knew.
Or the gym teacher from Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah, but that was later on.
No, I know.
Right, okay.
But same guy.
Right. So people might know him
soon
better.
To be.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and just as a side note, if you watch that E! True Hollywood documentary on the Comedy Store, one of the original comedians of the Comedy Store was Craig T. Nelson.
Yeah, I saw
the actor.
That. Yeah, that's weird. You forget about
it. He just seems like, I mean, I guess he played Coach. I guess that was a sitcom.
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty funny.
I never watched it.
He was in Poltergeist.
Yeah, that's what I think of. I think of Poltergeist when I think of Craig T. Nelson.
He's from Texas.
But he was like one of the first comedians of oh, he's a Texas guy?
Pretty sure, yeah. I think he's from Houston, maybe.
All right, okay, yeah. So when Tom Wilson, soon to be Biff from Back to the Future, moved in, again, like going on, this was sort of like a comedy incubator. Yakov Smirnoff was starting to appear on like TV, like on the Johnny Carson Show and Merv Griffin. And Wilson said that he would sit down and kind of role play doing panel with Yakov, so Yakov would be prepared when they sat down and did panel with Johnny Carson or Merv Griffin. You know, the panel banter after you do the stand-up set.
That would have been something to see, seeing Biff interview Yakov Smirnoff.
And we're talking about before, it was Tom Wilson, actually, Biff, who helped Yakov Smirnoff carry an 8-foot painting of Yakov Smirnoff into the entryway of the house to hang over the Marin staircase.
All right, yeah, so they're even better. Biff carrying an 8-foot-tall painting of Yakov Smirnoff.
Yeah, you'd want that on those video highlights reels.
But, you know,
the fake banter and the painting carrier.
But it was, you know, Harmon, wasn't all, you know, midnight parties and fun and games. I mean, these guys are all living together in a house. And the problem is he did have one neatnik who, surprisingly enough, was Andrew Dice Clay. And he would get very mad because nobody else would do their dishes.
Yeah, and at one point he got so mad that he said, "If you don't do the dishes, I'm going to throw them out the window." and he probably threw in some homophobic, misogynistic words probably as well if he's keeping in his Dice character. And he took all the dishes and he threw them out the window.
That's how we throw them in Brooklyn.
So in 1985, that's when Sam Kinison officially moved in. And that's pretty much when all hell started to break loose, because Kinison was at the kind of at the breakout point of his career. He just like stormed it on HBO Young Comedian Special, and which led to being on The Tonight Show and on Letterman and theater tours and hosting Saturday Night Live. And that's pretty much when all the cocaine started to come in into the party house.
Yeah, I mean, just to throw this out there too, is like, yeah, that's also the year that, so 86 was when his super featured role in Back to School came out, and that's, you know, that kind of put him over the top as well.
I was up to my knees in rice paddies with guns and N-words going up against Charlie, slugging it out with him while pussies like you were back there partying, putting headbands on, doing drugs, listening to the goddamn Beatle albums.
Hey, Professor, take it easy, will you? I mean, these kids, they were in grade school at the time. And me, I'm not a fighter. I'm a lover.
Yeah, and so he was like partying, you know, to say a cliche, like a rock star, which ironically, there was a lot of rock stars that just loved Sam Kennison, and they would come and party at the house. Like people like CC DeVille from Poison and Tommy Lee from Motley Crue. Corey Feldman possible there. And for some reason, friends of Sam Kennison, and they would all, you know, just party. They would, I forgot who it is. It would be like people would go to bed or they come home and it would just be a group of like a dozen guys that have been up like all night still partying like in the afternoon.
Yeah, I mean, that's that was just like crazy. Yeah, that was like that. Talked about that, to go back to that other outlaw comic guy, Carl LeBove. Him and his wife got married in 1985, to his wife Christy, and that's the Crest Hill House is where they had their after their reception, their impromptu reception. Mm-hmm. And that's the one that resulted into like a 3-day party with, you know, rock stars, everybody there, and everybody just going crazy.
Yeah, and there's one rule Mitzi had about the house is that there no couples allowed. You just had to be like single. And again, it was like there were a few women who that lived in the house, but for the most part, you know, it was like a boys' club that lived it. And again, who would you think would be the most anal retentive? Andrew Dice Clay, who didn't do drugs, and he wanted to sleep, and he got, you know, pretty tired of the all night parties. So he went and he told Mitzi all about it, and they ended up kicking out Carla Bow and his wife and Sam Kennison out of the house. And that is what instigated the long-running Sam Kennison, Andrew Dice Clay feud.
Yeah, that we've seen so far. I think we played it one of the last shows, but there's a clip of him on Arsenio Hall show, and that was like what year is that clip from? That had to be...
it was probably about 90 when Ford Fairlane came out. Yeah, so we're about 91, around that time frame.
Yeah, 5-6 years later, these guys are still pissed at each other.
Oh my God. And it's like, it was just weird because it was like Sam Kennison on stage would tell audiences that he hoped Andrew Dice Clay would die of inside out stomach cancer. Which I don't know. I guess maybe, again, am I like the judge reading Lenny Bruce transcripts that I'm just missing the context here of why that would have been funny?
Yeah, no. It was just, it's, you know, somebody with a lot of power and somebody.
Anger.
Yeah, anger. And people were gonna,
and a lot of drugs.
Yeah, and a lot of drugs. Yeah, let's not leave that part out. Yeah.
And they said for the most part it was a sort of a one-sided feud because I think Dice was always like, hey, look, they always want to get the guy who's on top. They're always trying to get the guy who's on top. And Sam Kennison was like, I hope he gets inside-out stomach cancer.
Yeah. I mean, from what we've talked about in our last episode and this episode and what I read, you know what? Yeah, I might not like the Andrew Dice Clay character. But the person seems like an all right guy, you know, like kept to himself, like to sleep, did his dishes. He would have been a good housemate.
So what you're saying, if you had to choose a roommate, you would have chose Andrew Dice Clay, Andrew Silverstein over Sam Kennison.
Yeah. Like who would you pick of all these guys? And let's go back to these are technically housemates and not roommates.
Oh, I'd have Yakov Smirnoff for sure.
Well, yeah,
that's like I'd pay to be Yakov. Yakov, do you need help with that 8-foot painting of yourself? I'll hang it up for you over the stairwell.
And I pay you in powdered donuts. Yeah, no, that would be like the triumvirate.
Yakov, do you want me to pretend to be Johnny Carson and interview you again?
Hey, Andrew Dice Clay, can you do the dishes again? You know, so you got him doing the dishes. You got Yakov Smirnoff fixing all the plumbing and hanging up paintings. You know, that would be a sweet house.
Yeah, the three of us, that would be all right. But on the other hand, Sam Kennison and Carl LeBeau lived there with his wife, and Sam Kennison was the other roommate. And in 1992, after Sam Kennison's death, it was disclosed that Carl LeBeau's wife, who had a daughter, was actually fathered by roommate at the time, Sam Kennison.
Oh my, what a surprise.
Yeah, not a good roommate. No, not a good roommate.
So he would be the worst roommate then to have.
Yeah, and about this feud, this sounds sort of funny, but I think then he sort of little bit into the racist thing. Like he would tell people like Dice is Jewish, so why do they call him? We shouldn't call him Dice. We should call him Dreidel. So Sam started calling him Dreidel.
Yeah.
And in turn, Dice told him to go fuck himself.
Yeah, it's not really that funny.
Yeah, a little bit racist.
Yeah, a little bit.
He went for the he played the Jew card.
Yeah.
In his like anger, which is I don't know if that not too cool from a former preacher.
Not as racist as all as our other housemate at the time, Ollie Joe Prater, and. If you could drop in a little of his banter there.
Yeah, so when was he a housemate, Ollie Joe Prater? Oh. And here is a little clip of some very dated 80s comedy that just wouldn't play so well in 2018.
I've been up since 3 o'clock this afternoon. Got some bad news, folks. I was just sitting in the office watching TV. Reverend Jesse Jackson just pulled out of the Democratic National Race for President of the United States. Yes, it's a big scandal. They found some pictures of his mom in an old National Geographic. You know?
Yeah, he was just one of those 80s comics that does not date well.
Yeah, so that must have been around 85, 86. But if you listen, I heard an interview with Pauly Shore, who actually said Ollie Joe Prater is his name.
Mm-hmm.
He'd never seen a comedian kill on stage like that comedian did at the Comedy Store. He just said he was just like one of the heavy hitters of the Comedy Store. Never became famous. Now his material extremely dated because it's overtly racist.
What? Yeah,
but he died early. I think he had a stroke. Yeah, and like
he was kind of
looked on a Wikipedia.
Big fellow, but I think even that little clip. I mean, I think I could see. I bet he was a popular because I could see him being popular with crowds, and he was probably one of those guys who could go up without any material, you know, and just kind of do crowd work, and you know, people would just love that. You know, they love that kind of stuff. So. Yeah, and he's got nothing.
Yeah, he's like an overweight guy in a cowboy hat. And you just know that guy went on the road and did one-nighters, and he would just probably be like the king of one-nighters.
Yeah, oh yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that was that thing. But that was back in the 80s, excuse me, when you could make a living at that. And you cannot be on making a living. You can make a lot of money at it.
Oh, yeah, you're making like $1,000 a week in 80s money.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it would be, yeah, so, you know, yeah, again, it was part of the comedy boom where because you worked the Comedy Store, you could headline for $5,000 a week, you know, in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And it was oversaturation. There was too many clubs and not enough comedians. So it's like, you know, comedians like that were like, you know, kings of the hinterlands of these obscure sort of comedy venues where you could see that, that guy would just kill on the road, but, you know, it just wouldn't play in, you know, like
normal place,
New York or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So at the time, you know, because of like Sam Kennison and his love for, you know, cocaine and becoming a star, you know, again, the Crest Hill House was attracting people like, okay, not only like Billy Idol, Corey Feldman, but also it says here, Ted Nugent.
Yeah, that would have been awesome. And then there is the
But Ted Nugent never drew, he was a teetotaler too. Yeah. But he was probably there just for the chicks.
Yeah, he was just there for the ladies.
Chicks and the guns, because like Sam Kennison
like guns.
I think he had guns.
Yeah, and then there's the rumor that Eric Clapton was there one night and kind of played an impromptu gig. But nobody can confirm that really. It's just like different people kind of tell the story, but nobody's story seems quite straight.
Yeah, and like what Corey Feldman said, on any given night, on any day of the week, there would always be about 10 or 12 comics at the Crest Hill House crowded around the massive oak table in the center, which was always full of a mountain of cocaine, which would get tiring. And then came the arrival of another comedian. I don't think he partied so much, Jim Carrey.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Feeling a little strange tonight, and I'm not sure why. No, I'm kidding you. That's just a little bit of a physical gag to get the show started off with a bang. And, well, you won't be seeing much more physical humor in my show.
Right. No, he was probably, he was doing his thing.
Yeah, but again, like going back to this was sort of a comedy incubator, like Jim Carrey's original act was he would do like these impressions, like he'd go, he would like contort his face going, I'm James Dean and all that. And you can find the clips on YouTube and it's kind of funny, but he told Sam that he was like so sick of his act. And then, you know, there, like Sam told him to, you know, drop it and just become yourself. And he actually stopped doing his act where I think it was like opening for Rodney Dangerfield in Vegas. So, you know, he was making good money being a comedian, but he completely ditched his act. And then he went through a period where he would just go up on stage with no material and just, you know, try to incubate, you know, trying to reinvent his voice,
right,
and his routine. But he completely ditched like a Vegas worthy act, which was probably making him good money to like. And he was just like so sick of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, he just wanted to kind of reinvent himself.
Well, Hartman, this brings us to the year, the faithful year of 1987, where we had a young comedian from the East Coast by the name of Mark Maron who moved into the room that Andrew Dice Clay had recently vacated. And he simply describes his time as a big, dark baptism. And like Kinison before him, he worked as the doorman at the Comedy Store while also doing sets and then staying at the Crest Hill House.
I guess we are spiritually bankrupt to a certain degree. You know, I don't know. I think it's because God doesn't talk to people like he used to. I mean, you read the Bible, it's like every other day. Yeah, Abraham, this is God. Go to the mountain, bring your kid, kill him. I'll be your friend.
Yeah, so he described his time of being at the Crest Hill House. It was like an initiation that turned out to be one of the most disturbing and mentally destructive 8 months of his life.
Yeah, he still talks about it on his podcast. He talks about it a lot.
Yeah, so like one night early on, he just found himself doing blow like one-on-one with Sam Kennison. And I think Sam was burning money. Literally or just figuratively?
Probably just figuratively.
I don't know.
Up the nose, yeah. Just like that.
Yeah, so Mark Maron was kind of the new guy, and he talks about in this BuzzFeed article that one night the coke ran out, so he drove Kinison to his drug dealer's apartment where Kinison downed like several airplane bottles of Smirnoff before passing out, and the drug dealer insisted that Maron drag Kinison home because he didn't want another Belushi on his hands. Or I said, oh no, the quote was, I don't want him to pull a Belushi on me.
Right.
Which was a reference to John Belushi, who did drugs and died at the Chateau Marmont.
Yeah. So Mark Maron would threw Kinison in his car, drove him back to Crest Hill, and then he pulls him out and just laid him face down on the living room floor, and Kinison went to sleep, which according to Maron, he did a lot. And so Maron quickly became, he kind of became the side host of the parties. He would kind of host the parties that Sam would want to have. And for some peculiar reason, a Hollywood reason, they would have their biggest parties on Monday nights when everyone who was anyone from all over the dark crevices of Hollywood would crawl in to see Sam.
Yeah, he would hold court there. And for some reason, Mitzi generally kept her distance away from the house, and at one point the house itself started to resemble its inhabitants a little bit, kind of haggard, just like things were just falling apart and not being fixed, and there was like guys living in every nook and cranny. You'd go into the basement and there'd be like someone huddled in a sleeping bag or someone like on a mattress. So again, the house was just sort of coming to a breaking point. And Carl LeBeau said he'd be gone all day, then he'd work as a doorman at night and do his spots, and he'd come home and there'd just always be a big party until like to late hours of the night. But he said like the upside was the balcony of the house was kind of the big you know, point. You'd be a young comedian, and you look out on the city and just look at, like, you know, celebrate, you know, what you've given up to go fulfill chasing your dream of comedy.
Yeah, I mean, that's a nice bookend to this time where, like, things started getting really dark with Kinison. You know, people were just saying Kinison was out of control. He would just do a lot of drugs and get really violent. Just anybody else who was there. I think Marin talks about one party where Kinison smacked around one of the guys who was booking at the Comedy Store, and he smacked him around and then all of a sudden kissed him on the mouth.
Yeah, because he's messed up with drugs.
Yeah,
this is dark. Yeah. He says, like, another point, a girl passed out on a bed and Kinison pissed on her. And as Marin said, which goes understatement, it was fucked up shit. And after 8 months of living in the house, Marin realized that he was starting to become into mental trouble, and he realized someone was going to die or someone's going to go down for real, and it could be me.
Yeah. I mean, then we get into tales of from Marin dealing with Kinison and Satan worshiping heroin addicts and stolen guitar equipment and people getting dangled over the balcony and doors getting kicked in. I mean, things were getting pretty out of control there.
Yeah, I think that one time, he let some heroin addicts sleep in his room, and like Kinison had his guitars in Marin's room. And Marin went to go pick up his friend at the airport. And when he got back, Sam, who was doing coke at the table, said, I pissed on your bed, Marin. You want to know why? Because you let that moron sleep with my guitars. And Marin turned to his friend, who he picked up at the airport, and said, see, I told you I knew the guy.
Yeah, so he was...
meaning Kinison.
Yep, he was more... wanted to make sure that his friend knew that he knew Kinison more than his pissed on bed.
Yeah, so the final straw of kind of ending this sort of era would be, like, I think after one ruckus party, Kinison led revelers into tossing all the expensive pieces of furniture off the back deck. So by 1988, Mitzi decided enough was enough, and the comics were told to get the hell out of the Crest Hill, and the party was over.
Yeah, that was the end. The end of the end was 1988.
Oh, yeah, because in 1988, the comedians still lived there, but Mitzi did a 360, and she turned the Crest Hill into a halfway house for... surprise, spoiler alert, a lot of these comedians ended up with substance abuse problems, such as Argus Hamilton, who was like, why we haven't heard of him is, like, basically drugs and alcohol destroyed his career.
Well, he's still out there, Harmon. I think Argus, if you go look at his website, I think he would argue with you that his career is, he's doing all right. He's not hosting The Tonight Show like everybody thought he was going to.
Oh, dude, I don't know, dude. I think it becomes at a point, it's a Dante level of purgatory when you're just, you know, on the road, you know, after decades.
Well, I mean, his humor column appears in over 100 publications if you go to the ArgusHamilton.com website.
According to the Argus Hamilton website.
Yeah, that was a plug for old Argus. It was like a for real halfway house, dorm rooms, you know, and there was a counselor with a medical license on duty at all times there in the house, so it was like group therapy, everything you'd need in a recovery type house for
they had a guy stay there at night to make sure nobody hurts themselves, and then going 360, Argus Hamilton moved back to the Crest Hill house.
Oh, that's beautiful.
This time, because it was a halfway house.
Right. He was getting ready to work on his website, ArgusHamilton.com. Yeah.
So you think that would be the end of the story, but uh-oh, every story has a second act. This would actually be the third act. The last comedian to live in the Crest Hill house. Any idea, Scott?
A comedian lived there would be...
Who might have had a mom that owned the Comedy Store...
Would it be the weasel?
So I'm kind of bummed out, though, because I didn't grow up in the middle of the country. I grew up in Hollywood. I don't have that family upbringing like you guys with the Wonder Bread, the gravy, dad coming downstairs in his polka dot boxers. Pull my finger, you know. That, you know.
Hey, buddy. No comedy weasel.
Yeah, so in 1991, Pauly Shore, whose mom is Mitzi Shore, ended up living in the Cresswell house, and he actually filmed some of the episodes of his MTV show Totally Pauly were filmed at the locale.
Yeah, I think even at the time, Mitzi was kind of pushing for them to do some kind of sitcom kind of based in the house. They were trying to sell it that
way. Oh, yeah, yeah. We forgot that bit. They actually did. They filmed a pilot like sometime in the 80s. And according to the people that saw it, it was awful.
No, yeah. You couldn't. I don't think you could do a sitcom. I think you could do a...
Well, I think you could do something. Yeah. There's something like a house full of comedians living together. Oh, my God.
Well,
throwing the dishes out the thing. I think if they made it like how it was, that would be interesting.
Well, that would be hard.
I think you'd have to... Not a sitcom. I think you just have to. It would have to just be really dark, you know.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It'd be
like
to be crazy,
a stand-up Breaking Bad sort of thing.
Yeah. And just the amount of drugs that were going around in the 80s, but even in the 90s, like even while Pauly was there, then they continued to kind of party there. For example, Brett Ratner lived there in 1996.
Yes.
We also had
Rush Hour director. Right?
And
yep.
Then speaking of drugs, we had Andy Dick living there for a while, Stephen Baldwin, Anna Nicole Smith, Allison Chains lead singer.
Well, I don't think they were living. I think they were just people who would party there.
Oh,
I don't think that last group are people that lived there.
Okay.
But yeah, those are people that would come to the
party. They would come to the party. No. They were just partying with Brett Ratner and Pauly Shore, maybe.
Yeah, and one person back in his drug days used to sometimes stay in the basement, Robert Downey Jr. But then again, he would also crash in strangers' houses in Malibu,
yeah.
Who would have to call the police.
To find Robert Downey, yeah. That, the boy liked his drugs.
Yeah. So basically, that just to bring us back to modern day, the current owner is a man named Josh Abrams, who's a recording executive who's worked with such artists as Pink and Katy Perry. And the house is now listed on the market for $3.29 million.
Oh, man, that's a hefty paycheck right there.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty hefty paycheck. But I went on the real estate listing site, and they actually trumpet up the fact that this was the Coke-fueled party house.
Oh, wow, really?
Here's what it said on the real estate site. When the Comedy Store shut down for the night, the late-night crowd used to scoot up the street to Crest Hill, where guests included the likes of Willie Nelson, Robin Williams, Rod Stewart, and, in parentheses, a mountain of cocaine.
All right.
This is on the real estate site.
Well,
in L.A., they say, yeah, cool, all right. Yeah.
Well, it was L.A. real estate listing.
Yeah, in New York, I think it would be a bit different.
Yeah,
you would trumpet a mountain of cocaine.
No, just back in the day, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a final footnote. Like, Pauly Shore at one time was, after he moved out, like, up recently, within the last few years, was interested in trying to buy the house.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think his brother works in real estate.
Yeah.
I met his brother one time. I got to cover the Cannes Film Festival, and there was like American Pavilion, and his brother would always be at the American Pavilion. It was kind of like just a hangout spot, like a tent.
Yeah.
So, and I think he worked in real estate as well.
Yeah, I think so. Apparently, that's his twin brother or something. It's like, yeah, that's kind of weird. You're thinking about there's another Pauly out there.
Does he? No, he doesn't have a twin. This is his older brother. Okay, I think his brother's name is Scott or something like that.
All
so,
right.
Yeah. Like your name.
That's me, Scott.
So I think that just about does it for the history of the Comedy Store condo here on
Comedy History 101.
Scott, do you have anything you'd like to plug?
Drugs. Sorry, I'm still stuck in the 80s, Armin. Whoa, let me get out.
Whoa. What in Russia?
Drugs.
Coke on Mirror watches you.
Mirror does you. Well, Harmon, you and I have our podcast. This is The President. Coming up soon, we'll have your guest appearance where you're talking about LBJ's dog. So that's going to be pretty exciting, and look for that in the next couple of weeks. You can find that on wherever you can find your favorite podcasts, like iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play.
Yes, and if you like our podcast, please support us. We need your support. Subscribe on iTunes. Leave a comment. We will read your comments here on the air. And also support us. Throw in a dollar or two on our Patreon page. Am I saying that correctly?
That's it. I think that's it. Yeah, not what were you calling it? Palladium?
Patreon.
No, you're calling it
something. Yeah, PalladiumCon.
PalladiumCon.
Yeah.
Patreon page. Yeah, Patreon.
Yeah, just throw in a dollar or two. Support the podcast. Help us keep going, because we enjoy putting in the extra time for you guys and finding out these interesting bits of comedy history. One last thing for me to plug is I have a new book out. It's called Meet the Deplorables, Infiltrating Trump America. And, of course, you can find that on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And until next time... Bye bye bye.
You're stupid. Everybody so stupid.
Good thing about doing comedy in Russia, you have captured audience.
You're stupid. Everybody so stupid.
Comedy History 101.